Well, it really is a great pleasure to be here and to help celebrate Stu and Ray's 65th. As Ed said, I was actually a graduate student with Stu from, I think, 79 to 83, and I have very fond memories of that time. I mean, as I'm sure you all know, Stu has a very sort of broad intellectual interest, and he made an absolutely ideal supervisor. We had these weekly meetings, not only to discuss my thesis, and we sort of enter that meeting in one of three possible states. The first possible state was that I would have done my homework on the thesis, and we'd spend an hour or so discussing that. That state was actually a rather rare case. Stu insists it actually only happened once in 4 years. He also at one point insisted it only happened before I was his student, and after his student it never happened again. State two, which was much more frequent, was that I would sort of come into his office and I'd be really quite excited about some problem or idea that I was working on that was completely unrelated to the thesis, and I'd talk to him briefly about this, and then he would think about that, and as long as this was anywhere in science, basically, he would get involved, and the two of us would talk about this and find sort of the most probable path to enlightenment. And so I sort of exit the office with feeling very good and feeling, okay, this is the direction that we go. So, well, you know, working with Stu was wonderful. He was an ideal supervisor. I'm sure he still is. I feel a little bit guilty that I was not an ideal student, but if I hadn't done my homework and the latest idea had crashed and burned and there was no progress, then I think auto mechanics was a good thing. We, you know, suspensions in Datsuns versus Triumphs was a popular topic of conversation. So let me just, what I'm going to talk to you about is actually a spin-off in the end of one of the conversations with Stu, and here's this is one of these synthetic things, right? This is the outline of the talk. We're going to talk about the telegraph equations versus the Dirac equation and show that there is a link that's actually within classical statistical mechanics. But one more thing I was going to say about Stu is, which I'm sure you all know, that he, you know, he pursues his interests with great passion, but also with humor. And let me just give you a quote that I remember well from the time, and I very much enjoyed, that statistical mechanics is easy, and all you ever have to do is count. Of course, it's quite true. Sort of the corollary to that is the trick is to find the right objects to count, and that's the thing. Well, what we're going to do, the problem that we're going to look at actually is finding the right objects to count to sort of address a problem that is usually not addressed in sort of standard textbooks. So I just want you to look at this table. I'm not trying to work this thing. Well. Sounds like a good, this one? Oh, there it is. Oh, yeah, good, okay. So, in this column here, just note that there are three equations. This one, of course, you're all familiar with, the diffusion equation. These guys up here are telegraph equations, or related to the telegraph equation, which is basically, describes diffusion, but with an inner scale, right? In the diffusion equation, you don't have an inner scale, and the signal velocity is infinite. And the thing about all of the equations in this column is that we understand them by something that lies underneath, basically kinetic theory. Right? We know that, you know, random walks tells us really about how this equation comes about, and we know what the solutions are. They're either concentrations or probabilities. Now, if we look in this other side, well, they're just the same equations except for this little red I here, right? Square root of minus one. And of course, it completely changes the character of the solutions. Okay? And formally, what one does to get to quantum mechanics is you split this in surreptitiously. Okay, and you want to get rid of it, you set it to 1, but of course that changes the character of the solutions. And as a result, you don't really know what these psis represent. So the equations on the right are fundamental. The equations on the left are not. They're really phenomenologies. There's something underneath them. And the question is, by judicious choosing what you count, can you actually get these guys on the right from classical statistical mechanics? And the answer actually happens to be yes, at least in certain circumstances. And then what we're going to look at is we're going to look at this first one. Right, so the one on the left is the telegraph equation, which is, again, it's like diffusion, but it has a mean free speed, which is fixed. And the one on the right is the Dirac equation in 1 plus 1 dimension, one of the versions of it. So what we want to do is we're going to look at the guy on the left, see how you get it from kinetic theory, and just see whether there's any way we can use the same idea of just counting recognizable objects to get the guy on the right. So here's the way you get the telegraph equations. Imagine random walks that sort of look like this. There's a lattice that's too fine to see on this thing, and the idea is the walker just proceeds to the right at a fixed speed, which is 1 in this thing, until eventually, by some stochastic process, it decides to turn left. So the paths sort of look like this, and the probability of changing direction is proportional to the lattice spacing, which is epsilon, and there's some constant of proportionality, m. So if you just look at that and sort of write down the probability density is 2-component, right moving and left moving, you can think of the whole hopping process as a Markov process, and so you can say here, well look, here's the transition matrix, right? It's just a simple transition matrix. In order to track the probability of landing up at a position, particular position at a particular time, you just do a little bit of stuff that allows you to count where it is in the XT plane. And so you just form a Fourier transform, and then you take a continuum limit. So you let the lattice spacing epsilon go to 0 in just the right way. And when you do that, you find basically the partition function looks like this. It's got these hyperbolic functions in it, and it's got the exponential decay. So this ultimately gives the telegraph equations, which is what you sort of wanted for those equations on the left. And if you look at this, if you look carefully at just what's happening here, and you look at this two-component equation, you can just see all this equation actually says about this is, well, hey, the particles never get lost. They either go straight or they turn left, and that's it. So that's basically the content of this two-component equation. It's very straightforward, and you can understand it from kinetic theory. So let's just see whether we can do the same thing for the Dirac equation. Now, somewhere we've got to get the square root of minus 1 in there, but it's a two-component object. So we're going to have to imagine what we'll do this. Well, let's just imagine putting down oriented rectangles in a plane. So this is what we're going to do. Here are oriented rectangles, and these distances here will be stochastic. They'll be governed by the exponential distribution. And you can see these have different orientations. Here's left, right, left. And we want to count those things, right, and count them with respect to their orientation. So what we can actually do is say, well, all right, let's look at the right-hand boundaries. Notice one of the things about this, the putting these oriented squares together, the boundaries join up, and if we concentrate on the blue, where the blue sort of goes out to large T and then comes back along the red. So it's actually a single path. The boundaries form a single path, which means you can form a whole ensemble of these things. So then the idea is, okay, well, let's count these things. If we're just going to count them, then the counting will actually go according to, say, the right-hand boundary. So you get a 1 here, a 1 here, minus 1, minus 1. And we can do the counting in exactly the same way that we did for the telegraph equations, except now, because we've got the orientation in here, we've got positive and negative. Let's just see what happens to that transition matrix. Oh, okay, so there are, in a sense, when we do the counting, there are 4 states instead of 2. We had right moving, left moving. We've got now got two more, which corresponds to the other side of these oriented rectangles. So there are now four states. So for the Markov process, it's going to correspond to a matrix with missing zeros. Okay, so unfortunately this slide didn't quite come through, but for this, the transition matrix looks just like the original one, except it's a 4x4, and when you do a change of variables to look at the sums of probabilities and the differences of probabilities, what happens is you get the original, really there's a 1 minus m epsilon here and a m epsilon here, m epsilon, 1 minus m epsilon. I don't know why that got missed. So here you just have the original transition matrix. Here, notice you have something that looks just like the transition matrix, but it has this minus sign here. This is the difference of the, you're looking for the difference of 1 minus 3 and 2 minus 4. So when you just continue that counting, it's actually the same calculations as you did before, but that minus isn't there. And a sigma x is actually, sigma x being the Pauli matrix, the sigma x is changed into I sigma y, which is still real, okay, but it has that that minus sign. So when you do that, you go through the same the same calculation. Notice the hyperbolic functions and now the trig functions, and you, zero or three?
Three.
Oh, good. Okay. You have instead of sigma x out here, you have sigma z sigma x. Sigma z sigma x squared is minus one. Okay. All this is doing is keeping track of the orientation. Okay. So this is what happens. If you count orientation, you actually get this thing. If you don't count orientation, you get what you expect. These things you understand to be probabilities. These things are actually net fluxes, the psi, because they are the difference between the occupations of two different states. So the neat thing about this is that you have the Dirac equation, which we all associate with relativistic quantum mechanics, but here it isn't relativistic quantum mechanics. It is simply a description of these oriented rectangles in the plane. Sorry, the what?
What do you mean by what is phenomenological about?
Okay. The phenomenological, in the sense that this equation here describes something underneath it, right? There's a phenomenology. If we throw down these oriented rectangles, that's the process we're describing. And the fact is, we know exactly what it is we're describing. Whereas this thing in the quantum mechanical context, we don't have anything underneath it, right? The psis are just, they're tools in basically an algorithm. So, okay, interesting experience. When's quantum mechanics? Okay, so the Dirac equation appears as a phenomenology in that there's a kinetic theory underneath it, okay? And what really happens is the oriented rectangles. If you're a high-energy physicist, you say, oh, wait a minute, those aren't oriented rectangles. Those are the virtual pairs. So this is really an organization of the Dirac C. And here, the phase of the wave function is a statistical smoothing of the four space-time directions. So here, the Pauli matrices are actually just vectors representing directions in space-time. Okay, so just comparing the two perspectives, so in the oriented rectangles, the wave function is really just a stochastic smoothing over orientation, whereas in quantum mechanics, the wave function is, it's a fundamental object. Phase is smooth direction. So the phase, the fact that you start out with four directions in space-time, you get phase from the wave function really is a smoothing of those four directions. Special relativity, we started out fixing the particle speed at C. That didn't change throughout the calculation. Lorentz Poisson distribution. The reason the Lorentz transformation works is because of a feature of the Poisson distribution, which links both the hyperbolic geometry and the regular trigonometry. Okay, so there's a relationship between the two. And I'm going to be chased out of here, so let me just just say the conclusion is the Dirac equation, you can derive it just to the limit of this counting process. So in a sense, the Dirac equation is simple. It's a matter of counting the right objects. Just notice that the boundary of these objects form a single a curve, and the new context is fully realistic. We know what's underneath it, and there's no, you know, we don't have to guess what the wave function is. So I guess that's it. Thanks for listening.